In the spirit of reconciliation, AMSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respect to their elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Hello, hello and welcome to the AMSA Ampule podcast. My name is Aidan and today I had the pleasure to chat to Dinesh Palapana. For those of you who haven't run into Dinesh in some way, he's an all-around good bloke and was the first quadriplegic intern in Queensland. We spoke a bit about his spinal cord injury and the challenges he faced there as a medical student and then a doctor, before spending much of the rest of the episode just having a chat about life and lenses in which you can view it. Today's episode is brought to you by BOQ Specialist. Not everyone is eligible to be a client of BOQ Specialist, but you are. As a medical student, you can join the numerous doctors who have chosen to trust BOQ Specialist with their finances throughout their careers. It doesn't matter if you're at the beginning of your degree or you're about to graduate. Their suite of products has been designed to suit your needs at every stage of your journey. BOQ Specialist has been working with medical professionals for 30 years, and throughout this time have come to understand your career and financial needs from studying through to exiting the profession. Other banks don't understand your career like BOQ Specialist does, particularly that you need support the most while you're studying. So whether you need help with course fees, overseas electives, or even a new laptop, BOQ Specialist are here to help you every step of the way. To speak to your local financial specialist, call 1300 131 141, or for more information, visit boqspecialist.com.au/students. Terms and conditions, fees and charges, and lending and eligibility criteria apply. Thanks very much for joining me today, Dinesh. If you don't mind, can you give us a quick intro of yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having me. My name is Dinesh. I'm currently a senior resident at the Gold Coast Department of the Gold Coast University Hospital. I graduated in 2016 from Griffith University. I have a spinal cord injury with quadriplegia, so I don't have the use of my fingers or anything below the chest, which happened halfway through medical school. So my career has been slightly different to the traditional path. And before med, I studied law, and I just finished the admissions course just recently to become a lawyer. So hopefully in September, I'll be getting admitted as a lawyer, not so much to work as a lawyer, but just cause.
Yeah, why not, hey? So one thing I'm sure you've had to explain many, many times is your accident and what happened and all of that. But I think it's a really interesting story and definitely one that I think medical students can benefit from. So do you mind going into that for us?
Yeah, the accident? Sure. Yeah. In 2010, I was in third year of medical school. And actually, I just started the clinical rotations and my first rotation was psych, which is probably a nice one to ease into clinical life with. And things were going really well. You know, I was living on the Gold Coast, had a great life, lived in this beautiful spot. I could see the ocean every morning, had a dream career. So everything was really good.
Yeah, all on track.
All on track. And I often used to visit my parents up in Brisbane, which is about an hour and a half drive. And on a Sunday, which was the 31st of January 2010, I went to visit my parents. I came back and it was one of those wet days. It was raining a little bit that day, on and off. And I was driving along the highway and it's pretty dark. It was about 8 p.m. I remember seeing something sort of shiny and slick coming up on the road, but it was a bit too late to avoid it. And I hit it. And as soon as I hit it, my car lost control, started aquaplaning, just went all over the road and hit an embankment, came back down and the nose hit the gravel and my car just started flying through the air, nose to tail. It landed after rolling and rolling.
Did you remember the actual...
Yeah, yeah.
Like while the car was flipping stuff?
Yeah, I was awake the whole time.
Yeah.
And actually, like, you know, I was pretty terrified when it was sliding all over the road. But once it started rolling, I realized that there's absolutely nothing I can do. And I decided to just enjoy it like a roller coaster. And that's the thought.
Yeah, free ride.
Yeah, exactly. So I just thought, I'm going to think of this like a roller coaster and have fun. And that was the thought I had. So I rolled and rolled and rolled, and then the car stopped rolling. And when it stopped, like, it was dead silent. Like, there was all this destruction and things flying around the cabin and glass shattering. But when it landed, it was just dead silent. And then I tried to get out of the car, and I realized I couldn't move. So third year medical student, I think I knew enough to know what had happened. And that's when, you know, that's when the realization hit.
Yeah, I guess that's a curse of having a bit of knowledge, like knowing that if you can't move straight away, there's a good chance that that movement may never come back.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you hear about, you learn about C-spine precautions and C-spine injuries and how severe these things are, but you never imagine that it happened to you. And you never imagine your life to go that way. And for 99% of people, it doesn't. But sometimes life just throws you a curveball, and that was it for me.
Yeah, right. So when, I guess, the ambulance would have came to the scene, what happened from there?
It's a funny thing, actually. When the ambulance came, was the first vehicle on the scene was a fire truck. And the fire truck also hit whatever I hit and lost control.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. They didn't crash. They just flew past my car, and then they just backed up. And they extricated my, you know, me out of the car. They cut the door open and whatever else. The ambulance came, and you know, my memory gets a bit hazy at that point. But what I do remember is looking up in the ambulance, and I see this guy, and it's this dude that's given us a lecture not that long before my accident. he was an emergency physician, and he's now the director of the Queensland Ambulance Service. But I remember watching his lecture, and I was like, geez, this guy looks like he has a lot of fun, and I'd like to do that in my career one day. It was and I remember that so vividly. So when I saw him in the ambulance, I was like, oh man, I know you. And we had this chat, but then I just went back to this realization that, holy shit, I've had a spinal cord injury. So the ambulance ride was, you know, one thing I remember about this, and I always talk about it, is that this was the start of my experience as a patient. And I'm sad to say that it is not fun being a patient. I was at Stanford Medicine X in 2018, and they had this forum of patients and doctors, and there was some discourse with them about the experience and whatever else. And these patients were saying that they hate going to hospitals now because they have like a PTSD from going to hospitals. They just hate it, and they'd rather be, you know, they won't go until they're on the verge of death. And funnily enough, I work in an ED every day, but it's the same for me. I will not go to the hospital as a patient unless I'm on the verge of death. And
yeah, right.
Yeah, it's really ironic because patients turn up in the ED and they're like, oh, you know, I hate being here. I don't want to be admitted to this. And I'm like, hey, I get it. I like coming here for work, but definitely not, you know, the situation that you're in. But one thing I remember is I think patients, they know that we have the technical skills to look after them. You're a doctor. There's a baseline trust in what you are able to do. So when I was in the ambulance with this guy, it wasn't really the technical skills that mattered. You know, I've seen him lecture. I knew that he was doing everything right and doing everything that he can. But what I do remember this is 10 years ago now, is what he told me and what his words were. And it was just that everything was going to be okay and they're going to take me to the best place for this kind of injury. And, you know, it's all that kind of stuff that mattered. And it's all that kind of stuff that I remember. And subsequently, I had some pretty terrible interactions with doctors. Just, you know, it's so disempowering and patronizing, and I've been told that I won't become a doctor and whatever else. So if I think, you know, he would have seen thousands of patients in the last 10 years, but he's just left an impact on my life that I will probably remember till the end of my days. And I think that's really the power that we have as healthcare providers, is to make that impact. And that's why I got into the job.
Yeah, so I guess that demonstrates the importance of not just, you know, prescribing the right drug, getting the diagnosis, but how you actually interact with that patient and how, I guess, I think you'd understand it for yourself, but I think a lot of us that haven't been in a situation like that can't really understand the fact that, you know, every patient you talk to, that's just your day-to-day, that's your job. But for those people, the time they spend in like ED or in the hospital, that's such a memorable part of their life and part of their life that impacts them so greatly.
Exactly. And we had a emergency physician in our department that always used to say, you know, what people remember is how you made them feel. And that's the most important. Because, yeah, like you said, we see people under the gravest of circumstances. And we do this every single day and we see terrible things every single day. But it's a terrible thing that happens to them once. And we have the opportunity to have an impact at that point in time. And that's really powerful. And it's, you know, it's also a big responsibility because you have the opportunity to shape the way they feel about that experience. Apart from a professional perspective, I think the humanistic aspect of that is incredible. You know, that's the position that we're put in, and that's why this is an amazing job.
Yeah, it really is a privilege, eh? For you, after your obvious life-changing event, because, you know, we're all taught to employ empathy to different patients, but I guess it really is difficult to truly understand the lived experience of, for example, someone that's had a C-spine injury. How useful for you has it been, you know, relating to other patients that have had life-changing events?
Yeah, it's been extremely useful because, yeah, like you said, we learn about, we try to learn these things in med school, empathy and communication and all this stuff. But, you know, when you've gone through an experience and when you remember how you felt, I was, you know, at some points I was angry being a patient because I didn't know what was going on. I didn't have an update. I felt, you know, I was this guy who was roaming around. I had such a short attention span that I didn't even sleep in my bed every night. I'd like go sleep on the floor or I'd sleep on my couch. Like, yeah. Yeah. So I was really quite, you know, I liked variety. I like, even in the little things in life, I just, that's what I was like. And then suddenly I was thrust into this world for 8 months and I didn't know when I was going to be discharged and when I was going to be out. And I had a bedtime. Suddenly I was awakened at whichever time the nurses decided. And I had a time to eat. I had a time to do therapy. Like, it was just suddenly so structured and that freedom was taken away. And that's frustrating, you know? And I remember that frustration. I remember that disempowerment and I remember that anger. And that's what I see when I see patients sometimes. Now, I remember this particular instance where I was handed over the care of a patient. And one of the things that was said was, okay, this guy's really difficult and making a scene and whatever else. You know, when you go into that interaction, with that background, you're immediately thinking, oh God, like this is going to take some time and it's going to be frustrating and whatever else. But when I actually, then I stop myself and think, wait, hold on, you were feeling this way all those years ago. And then you ground yourself again. And I went into that cubicle and had a chat to this guy. And he's, if you just take the time to listen to why he was frustrated, you know, he just said, look, I just don't know what's going on. And I get anxious when I don't know what's going on. I just need someone to explain to me these steps and why you're doing these extra tests and whatever else. So it took 2 minutes to explain the reasoning behind what was happening, at what might happen. And it settled the whole thing. So I think you just got to remember that we're here. Our business is patience. They're our customer, and that's why we have a job, and that's what we do if you look at it from that perspective. So our business is to service our customers the best we can, and that's, you know, that's the big part. So I think my experiences have definitely grounded me a lot more in how I deal with patients.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear. Especially, that sounds super cooked that you would be like imposed upon with a bedtime. That's just unbelievable to hear. But I guess, you know, in one sense, there's only so much the hospital and the system can do in terms of, you know, you need your medications and treatments at certain times. But I guess, is this another example of just doing as a, you know, medical professional, allied health, doing the little things, having those little conversations, trying to give a bit of power back to you? Because we talk so much in med school about, you know, the importance of, you know, autonomy is one of our four ethical pillars. And yet it just sounds like they just completely stripped that from you.
Exactly. And like you said, I know that we have to run things in a regimented way to get things done in the health system. But that creates frustration. But we can offset that frustration in other ways and try to make life easy for people. Autonomy is one, and non-maleficence is another one. Do no harm. You know, those two things, like how much harm are we doing to patients that don't want to come back and see us? How much harm are we doing to patients that we alienate from the system? So, you know, we need to keep that in mind.
Yeah, right. How was your interaction with like other med students? I imagine that would have been a bit weird.
Once I came back, it was it was challenging because it had been 5 years by that point, and some of my, well, most of my classmates were now registrars. And there were some really close friends that I had that used to come over to my house all the time, and we hung out together, played basketball, whatever else. So these guys were now registrars or whatever else. And then I came into a new class, and I got to say, everyone was really welcoming, curious perhaps, and pretty helpful as well. Like I made a couple of really close friends that, you know, just had been a part of my life since then. My interesting interactions actually came with the ones that had graduated and that I'd known previously. And there were some pretty challenging times where, you know, they'd kind of ignore me. They'd say that medical students are annoying. They'd walk right past me and sit with other registrars or doctors instead of saying hi. So there were some pretty confronting events, and there was one that I was actually attached as a medical student to that I knew from previously, and she was a nightmare. Like it was a, you know, constant even calls after hours, and just terrible. She used to make the interns cry and the medical students cry. So but this is a person that I knew before the accident. So there were two contrasting worlds, and it was challenging. And I think it's a reminder that we need to be kind to each other. It's been a pretty difficult time of late for people in healthcare. We've sadly, I know over the last 6 months, the profession's at least lost three colleagues that I know of to suicide. So it's a hard time for us. And if we can't look after each other and if we can treat each other properly, how can we look after patients?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And it does sound like, because I was speaking to Jeff Toogood, the founder of Crazy Socks for Docs Day, last night. And we were speaking about how on many levels, there's been a lot of really positive systematic change. There's been a lot of initiatives in many different spheres. But one thing that seems to still be lacking in many senses is the culture surrounding the workplace.
Exactly.
Like the sort of stuff like the person you knew, like making the interns cry, like what's the benefit there?
Exactly. I mean, it's and they were so notorious that they eventually got pushed out of the hospital. But why? Like why do we treat each other this way? I agree with Dr. Toogood in that there's been a lot of systemic change. There are a lot of programs in place. There are a lot of external support structures. But I think still the culture shift needs to happen, and it's us treating each other properly. It's us at work just checking in on each other, asking if someone's okay, asking the junior whether they need a hand, asking each other what's going on in our lives, and, you know, I find it really one of the things that I've noticed is that we as a profession sometimes really hone in on bits that people do wrong. And when someone makes an error, it gets talked about a lot. When someone makes a mistake, it spreads. But we don't really recognize the people, you know, that do well, that look after each other. Like it's just a bit flipped around to how it should be. And I think we need to take a deep look at ourselves, because we need to be a team and we need to be cohesive. And that's going to reflect upon us as people and as a profession.
Yeah, so I guess with that system where it's like, if you do, you know, bad things, you get punished. Obviously, that serves its purpose, but in the more social sense, which generates the atmosphere in which the workplace exists, it seems to me that most people typically will not be doing clear negative things. Mm. But for this culture shift to occur, they need to be going above the average in the positive scale to try and push a culture shift that way. But if there's not a system in which positive things are rewarded, that's less likely to happen. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, a lot, you know, our hospital has a system in place where if someone, if there's a difficult interaction with someone that affects patient safety, you can make a report, and then a peer has a chat to the person who is affected. And, you know, that's the stick approach, but we need the carrot as well. So we need to really recognize people that live up to these values that we aspire to, and we need that. But also it starts from, you know, we need to look to the new generation, you know, the medical students that are coming through now, and hopefully the guys that are going to be listening to this podcast. It's going to start there, you know, like it's going to be making sure that you have your friends back. It's going to be the group of interns that rally behind their friend going through a hard time. It's going to be the seniors that look after their juniors and even just buy them a cup of coffee and having a chat every now and again. It's, you know, that culture. I think if we can just shift to that sort of culture, we're going to make some huge leaps and bounds.
Yeah, definitely. No, I'd love to see that. That'd be great. So from, obviously your medical was interrupted, then you got through that. Could you tell me a bit about your transition from medical school to finding an internship? Because I've read up and it sounded like that was a big headache.
Yeah, I mean, inclusivity in medicine is a complex topic, but it doesn't actually need to be. You know, before this time, previously, women had a lot of issues in medicine. I read some old book that says that the female brain is too puny to practice medicine. I was like, wow, this is the kind of thinking that we have. Yeah, it's crazy to think about that.
Unreal.
Now. You know, we've come this far, but it's the same with people of different physical capacities, you know, and around the world, there are people that have done this. I know a doctor with quadriplegia who's the director of nephrology in the United States. There's a visually impaired pediatrician, I think. There's a pediatric surgeon who uses a wheelchair. So there's all these people. But when I graduated, it was still a new concept, particularly in Queensland. And I had a huge amount of trouble securing the internship. You know, as you know, like internships are guaranteed to the domestic graduates, but my application was taken out and it just went through this process. And again, one of the most frustrating parts was they just wouldn't tell me what's happening. Apart from, you know, I was like, can you just give me an update? Will I be starting work? What do I need to do? How am I going to survive the next year without an income? Like, do I need to find another job?
Yeah.
You know, should I turn up at McDonald's and...
Yeah, it's ridiculous to get a medical degree, go to McDonald's.
Yeah. But, you know, eventually, so I got this email once that said, it's very unlikely that you'll be starting your internship with your colleagues and nothing else. But the good thing was I had a lot of supporters in the medical school, doctors, the community, and the media were amazing as well. So by highlighting this story, I eventually got the internship last minute. It was literally like the Friday before the Monday that the intern started. I got a phone call. So yeah, it was wild. But you know, here we are 4 years later and things are going really well. Yeah. But it was frustrating, you know, and it's it was really annoying because you pass med school and you've been through the hospital as a third and fourth year medical student. You figured out how to do things and you got decent grades and awards and whatever else, but none of that matters because you have a spinal cord injury. That was really frustrating.
Yeah, that's pretty ridiculous to hear. Like, it's almost one of those things you wouldn't really expect, and the fact that, you know, you had to go to all these lengths, you know, contacting the media, all sorts of bodies for this to be pushed through. Where do you see that sort of climate now? Like, how have things changed since then and now?
I think we're starting to make a transition. I know that the medical deans of Australia and New Zealand are changing their stance. AMSA was a huge part of advocating for change because there was some policies previously that wasn't very inclusive to people with disabilities.
Yeah, definitely still a lot of work to be done, but it is quite reassuring to see a lot of the work that has been done and the work that's in progress. I'm on track to write my first policy for AMSA in the coming months. So I'm keen to get involved with that.
That's awesome. That would be awesome. AMSA has been really good. And like I said, I think, you know, it's the next generation that really has the ability to think forward and change things.
Yeah, definitely. So what else have you been up to outside of your working in ED?
I just, I love, you know, I've really gained a new appreciation for life because I, you know, a few weeks before the accident, I went snowboarding with one of my best friends. And, you know, I didn't really know that I wasn't going to stand in the snow again for some time. And the last thing I did before the accident was hug my mom. Those are all great things. And I realized how special life is and how you have to seize the day. So I try to do things that are just fun and interesting and hopefully makes an impact. And that's what I try to spend my days doing. One of the biggest things that I'm doing at the moment is a spinal cord injury research project, which is for purely selfish reasons. But
I think that's fair enough.
We got $2.1 million in funding last year, and we're using drug therapy electrical stimulation and thought-controlled rehabilitation. So there's been some early work done in Switzerland and the US that has been really promising in this area and has restored some function in people that have been living with chronic paralysis. And we hope to, we have to build this science so hopefully I can stand one day and hug my mom again. That's one.
Yeah.
And I've been doing a lot of work around inclusivity. So we have Doctors with Disabilities Australia that are founded with a couple of colleagues. And really it's been, we've been trying to give input on a lot of this work around the medical deans and whatever else to help with the profession. And that's been really cool because we've seen so much progress and we've been able to give input to projects in the UK and the US and even a court case that was happening in India. So that was really good. I do a bunch of other fun things as well. So I, the Gold Coast Titans NRL team has a physical disability rugby team as well. And I'm a doctor for them. Whatever else, I'm in the process of working on a book. And just other things that will hopefully make an impact in the world to, change people so they don't have to go through the challenges that I did to live my dream and make the world a little bit better, hopefully.
Yeah, that's awesome. Really, really great stuff. I'm particularly keen to see the spinal research field grow and see what they can come up with in the coming years. It's funny because I sort of somewhat ran into Perry Cross a few months back.
Oh, yeah.
He actually spoke at my graduation, my undergrad, and one thing that he said stuck with me and stuck with, I think, everyone at that ceremony. It was he gave a really engaging story about his experience, and then at the end of his speech what he did was he was like to the 500 graduating class, he was like, I'd like you all to stand up. And so we all stood up and he was like, in 2 seconds you have achieved my life dream. And it was just silence. It was incredible.
That is cool. Perry's an incredible guy.
Yeah. What's your relationship with him? How long have you sort of been involved with him?
Well, so with Perry, I am on his scientific advisory committee for the Perry Cross Foundation. And obviously we have very similar goals in what we want out of science. So we have a very, very good friendship and a close relationship.
That's great to hear. So jumping back a little bit, I'm curious about your experience working as a quadriplegic doctor in terms of patient interactions. Like, how are you treated by the patients?
That's a funny thing, because when I came back to medical school, there was one of the clinical supervisors had huge reservations about having me as a medical student, and they told the school that patients are not going to take this guy seriously and this and that. By the end of my rotation with him, he thought I was one of the best medical students he ever had. So that changed. But the patients have been 100% positive. There hasn't been one, which is amazing.
Oh, really?
Don't you think? Like, yeah, it even surprises me, actually. So there hasn't been a single one. And we had some, from the ED, we get emails with the feedback that patients send, cards and things. And this morning, actually, I was reading through a couple that patients had sent through. And it's so nice to read that. So I have to say that even to my surprise, 100%, like there hasn't been a single interaction. That was odd.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's really, really good to hear. But I'm pretty shocked at that. Like, I wasn't expecting that. I thought there'd be a lot of patients that would sort of like, turn their nose up at you.
Yeah, I'm pretty shocked at that myself. But no, patients are amazing. And I think it just goes to show that human beings are amazing. It's more, it's actually more just doctors that throw up barriers. And, you know, even then, like 95% of them are amazing. And who knows, maybe there's another 5% that don't tell me that they feel weird. But, you know, a lot of my colleagues and my bosses have been awesome.
So what are you planning on doing with getting, was it accredited as a lawyer?
Oh, yeah. So I'm getting, I'm getting admitted as a lawyer. I've applied to have the admission ceremony that's happening in September. So I finished my law degree before med, but I never got admitted. And the admission process involves doing practical legal training, which is a bit of coursework, and doing some time in a law firm or with lawyers. So I chipped away a little bit, bits and bits over the last 18 months in between my ED shifts, and I finished it recently. So I don't know, you know what, I have no great reason for doing that apart from it just feels like, it felt like doing med without finishing your internship, you know? So I was just like, cool, I'll get to go to a cool ceremony and have something nice to frame. No, it's actually going to be really good. I think my law degree has been really useful, and law gives you a bunch of amazing skills that I think has held me in good stead through life. So I'm very grateful for that opportunity.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's crazy the number of things you're just listening off that you're up to. I think as medical students, we're all, and I guess, you know, I don't have too much contact with them, but people that are in medicine as well, we find it very, very difficult to sort of do stuff outside of medicine because it's sort of this all-consuming beast. For you particularly, you know, dealing with your disability as well in work and outside of that, how did you find the balance, I guess, to pursue all the different things you're pursuing?
I don't think, medicine's just something, like, it's something I like. I think if you spend your time doing things that you like, whatever it is, then, you don't need to find a balance. We go through this dichotomy of work-life balance these days. And interestingly, while I was doing practical legal training, I read this thing by a lawyer who says, does it need to be like that? If you're doing something that you enjoy and if you want to spend 15 hours a day at work and that's your thing, then great. So I've just found a bunch of things that I really, you know, I do things that are interesting to me and that I enjoy and I want to spend time doing. So that it just, you know, just becomes a thing. So I've never really thought about it in the way that, you know, do I need to balance things out or whatever else? I just think, oh, this is interesting, I want to do that. One of the things that I do sometimes is go, okay, maybe I just want to spend a couple of days tuning out, or spend a day tuning out, or spend an evening watching Netflix and hang out with my fiance, who's a nurse. Nurses are good people, by the way. sometimes I just take a bit of time out, but really, if you're spending your time doing fun things, you won't really feel that work-life balance issue.
Yeah. Man, that's pretty deep. That's not really a perspective I'd really considered beforehand.
Yeah, I think it's very relevant to today because we talk a lot about wellness and we talk a lot about balance and all these things. But what is wellness? It's like it's an inner feeling. And I think you can't be artificial with it. Wellness is just whatever makes you feel good and well. And if that thing is spending 7 days a week doing whatever you love, then man, that's pretty good.
Yeah, great way to live.
Yeah, it's a brilliant way to live. And I think the greatest people on earth that we remember, the greatest minds, the most productive people, that are memorable, they've just found their craft and they've just beaten away at their craft every day. It's not work to them. It's just life and it's their passion. So you just need to find that. And I think it's important to mention this as well. Some of us go through medical school and maybe medicine is not our passion. And I think it takes courage to accept that. I recently had a chat with a junior doctor who just, you know, they just left medicine, or they left their job. And I know a bunch of people that have actually, and they've gone on to just do things that they really, really like. And that takes courage and that takes guts, but they are much happier people.
Yeah, I think that's, I spoke to another guy a couple of nights ago about that, and who left medicine to become a writer. And I guess, yeah, that's, I feel like we're often conjured with the belief that, you know, once you start your medical degree, that's it. You have to do medicine for the rest of your life. But I guess that's not so much the case if you find something else that you're, say, more passionate about.
Yeah, exactly. Me and my fiance and my mom even, we often talk about life becoming monotonous and repetitive and formulaic. So we have this formula in medicine. You go through med school, then you bust your ass to get into a specialty training program. Then you do that, and then you become a consultant. And then what? You suddenly got 30 years to spend. You've got through all this way, which is great. But then what? Like, what do you do with that? Do you just do that every day? And if that's your thing, that's great. But, you know, you do get to the point where you are at the end of training and you have this. So I think that we need to be careful about thinking that this is the be-all and end-all, because there is still life once you get through your training. And if you're not passionate about what you're doing, it's not only a loss to you, but it's a loss to the world, because you don't know what you're going to contribute to this world if you're not doing something that you're passionate about.
Yeah, and I guess that's also the I'm a big YouTube man. I like to watch my YouTube. And one thing that's come up in the sort of self-help sphere is the whole avoiding having a delayed life plan, in which you're sort of like, oh, okay, I'm going to get to this qualification, then I'm going to buy a house, I'm going to pay off the mortgage, and then I'll be happy, or you'll do this and that, and then you'll be happy. And I guess, yeah, it's a big thing to avoid, hey?
Yeah, really? Really? Like, is that it? Is that happiness? Is that happiness? Like, that is the prepackaged life that 2020 is. It's not happiness. You know, I met the Dilma guy, actually, you know, the guy that was in all the ads, do try it.
Oh yeah.
I had a chat to him, and he didn't start Dilma till he was 50 something. And now we're all drinking it around the world, and it comes out of this little island. So, you know, life plans, I don't think they really mean much. And you really need to have the courage to think outside of it. You know, we are trained as kids to seek this safe path, like get a safe job, buy the house, pay your mortgage, have the kids and do this. And like, is that really right for everyone? I don't know. It might be right for you, and which is great. But I think we all need to do a bit of soul searching to figure out what is it that we're supposed to be doing, because we all have something to contribute to this world, and we need to do that justice.
Yeah, I think I might need to do a bit of soul searching myself then. So you've dropped quite a few pearls of wisdom on us tonight so far. To cap it all off, do you have any final words of advice or just thoughts to give to the medical students of today?
Yeah, I think just considering the events of late, you know, like I said, we've lost some colleagues recently. I've seen some junior doctors and medical students really struggle over the last few weeks and months. I think that firstly, I love medicine. I think it's a great profession. I think we're privileged to be doing it. And to me, it's the best job in the world. But it may not be the best job in the world to everyone. It may be, you know, you may have fallen into it for one reason or the other, or you may have, which is why I did law. You know, I fell into it and I thought it was the right thing for me, but it wasn't. And I was actually depressed. I became depressed. I started having panic attacks. I had anxiety and I had agoraphobia as well. It was a terrible time. And I think back then, I always say that I was a prisoner of my mind, which is a much, much worse thing to be, because now I feel unlimited. But then I felt limited. I was too scared to go outside the house. And a part of the reason was there was an organic component to it, for sure. But also, I was just living a lie. You know, I hadn't found my passion. I hadn't found my heart. And I wasn't in touch with my soul. So my biggest piece of advice is don't go through life. Don't waste a minute more without finding what your passion is and what makes your soul sing, and free yourself and do that.
Yeah, that's great advice. Definitely something I'll be considering. But thank you very much, Dinesh, for taking the time to sit down and have a chat with me. I very much appreciated it, and I'm sure the listeners will as well.
Thanks a lot, Aiden. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Answers Ampule Podcast, where we discuss the things you don't talk about in med school. If you would like to find out more about spinal cord injury research, I encourage you to look up the Perry Gross Spinal Research Foundation. If you have any feedback for the podcast or ideas of topics or guests you'd like to see in the future, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me by email on podcast@amsa.org.au or shoot me a message on Facebook. The views, information, or opinions expressed during the AMSA Ampule series do not necessarily represent those of the Australian Medical Student Association.